Hey team, welcome to Rewriting Wellbeing, the Teacher's Health Podcast, the show that helps you thrive and not just survive, both in and out the classroom. Let's get into it. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. I hope you are doing really well. Today I've got another really special guest episode with you. Today I'm going to be sitting down with David Wilson, also known as Sober Dave. Dave is a grey area drinking coach, podcast host, best-selling author and motivational speaker, helping thousands of people around the world change their relationship with alcohol. Dave helps people stop the cycle of alcohol addiction, break free from the guilt and shame that can bring, and start living a life without alcohol, escaping the roller coaster of problem drinking, taking control of their mindset, and helping them ultimately to live a healthier, happier life. So I just had to get Dave on the podcast. Now, I've recently had a bit of a journey myself with stopping drinking and sobriety and sort of experimenting a little bit with that. And it's something that has really kind of piqued my curiosity, and it's something that I would love to share more about with you. So without further ado, here is Self-Worth, Sobriety and Starting Out with David Wilson. Dave, hello. How you doing, mate?
Hello, Charlie. How you doing, mate?
Yeah.
I'm all right.
Good.
Nice to see you. Last time I saw you was at Latitude, wasn't it?
It's been a while. Yeah, it's been a while. What we're going to talk about today, we obviously sort of started chatting about there, didn't we?
We did, and you've done really well since then. So I put that all down to our conversation.
Yeah, it played a big part. Jokes aside, it did. I'm sure we'll get to that later on. But like, yeah, it was a big part of it. 100%. Definitely good. gave me a bit of the confidence to make that change.
Yeah, well done, mate. I'm proud of you.
Cheers. Thank you. But yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into that because I've got a lot to kind of share on that. I've had quite a few questions about sobriety and stuff like that since. So yeah, we'll get into it today. But before we kind of do, can you just tell us a little bit more about you, sort of who you are now, I guess, as a person, what you do, who you help, how you help, and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so my name's Dave. A lot of people know me on Instagram as Sober Dave. And my life has completely changed since I stopped drinking, because for 40 years, I was Dave the Carpet, obviously in the industry from the age of 16. And it was quite interesting, actually, Charlie, because I worked in a lot of celebrities' homes when I was really young. And, you know, 16, 17, walking into places like Michael Caine's home to do their carpet and Jimmy Page and stuff like that was brilliant, because I worked for a guy in Battersea called Ricky Baker, and he had a bright orange VW Beetle and he had bright orange hair. So, you know, you could spot him a mile off, but I quite enjoyed it. Hard work, but I also ended up doing 60-minute makeover for nearly 10 years as well. So that was a brilliant part of my life. But, you know, my drinking was ridiculous. So when I gave up in 2019, everything changed for me. And so going back to your question now, I'm a full-time sobriety and mindset coach. I've got a podcast, as you well know, One for the Road, a book, audio book, courses, you know, to kind of change my career, because before I stopped drinking, I was training to be a counsellor as well, because I've always been interested in that line of work, you know, helping people and working out how we feel, how we react to things. But to be honest, I didn't do well at school. So for me to go back in the classroom 40 years later was complete rabbit in the headlights for me. And although I had a lot of abilities on the sort of learning side with the paperwork and the homework, I was pretty bad. Plus, I was drinking like a fool. And I was doing a lot of my sort of 1,500 word pieces in the pub. And I'd have two or three beers before I started. And by the time I finished, I'd had eight or nine. And I thought, this is the best thing they've ever going to read. And I pressed send. And when I went in the week later, they kind of kindly said, can we have a little word? And it was pretty bad, you know. So I did that for 2 years. But I had to give it up because my mum unfortunately died and everything went haywire then. But then I've got into this and I've trained to be a grey area drinking coach and I've done lots of other different courses. And do you know what, Charlie? I absolutely love what I do now because there's so many benefits to it and helping people is something I've always wanted to do as well.
Yeah, it's amazing, mate. And I admire you for so many different reasons, like the community you've built, the work you do, the message you spread, your content, everything. Like, I'm a big fan. Like, I really do
Oh,
admire
thank
you.
you, Charlie. Thank you.
So me and you at Latitude was brilliant. Like, that was awesome. That was a really good day. But yeah, I've wanted to get you on here for a long, long time because I think lots of what we're going to talk about today and what you sort of mentioned there is going to resonate a lot with teachers, kind of the use of alcohol and things like that. I know just from the clients that I've worked with,
Yeah.
it's some of those challenges are things that come up quite a lot. So I think this episode is going to be really, really powerful for people. But it's really interesting. I didn't know you did 10 years on what was it? I forgot what it's called, Makeover.
60-minute makeover. Yeah, I started and I worried about it actually because I was drinking indoors all the time. It had gone from social drinking to isolated drinking, and I did a stint on that DIY SOS, and I did 2 days on that, and I put it on my website, and then I got an email saying we're looking for a carpet fitter to go on to 6-minute makeover. And I thought it'd be like a one-off thing. So I went for the interview at ITV and I got the gig. And it's amazing, you know, because that changed my life as well, went in a different direction there. And when I turned up for the first day, it was in Coventry. I thought, oh my God, how am I going to manage not really drinking? But the night that I met them, everyone was drinking. Like, TV is a big drinking culture, like a lot of others, you know. And I think I got into my hotel room at 2:30 in the morning or something, and I was starting my first day on the makeover.
Oh.
I didn't know how it worked. And I absolutely fitted in perfectly, you know, it really suited me. And they gave me the full-time job there, and it was seasonal, so it was like 20 weeks of makeovers. And we traveled all over the country, and it was a big, you know, work hard, play hard attitude as well. But I also used to smuggle in bottles of wine in my suitcase in case we weren't in the bar all night and stuff just to keep myself going, you know. And I remember once we had a bit of an early one, and I had two bottles of wine in my hotel room. And when I got to the set in the morning, the cameraman said to me, "Bloody hell, Dave, you absolutely stink of booze." And we'd all left the bar at like 7:30. So it was that awkward moment for me of like, how can I get away with this? Do you know what I mean? And I just
Yeah.
didn't say anything. But yeah, it was a good time in my life. I met some amazing people. And ironically, two of the designers that I work with are now sober as well. So that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
I got to meet the wonderful Peter Andre. I worked with him for 3 years as well. And everyone says, is he really as nice as what they say he is? And he is. He's just absolutely lovely person, you know, really lovely to work with and a friend and whatnot. And yeah, lovely bloke.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I think it's important, isn't it? Because obviously during that time you had a lot going on for yourself and personally and things, but there were also some amazing, it sounds like some amazing highlights as well. I think it's quite hard when you look back on those periods of life to not just see the darkness and just see the challenge. Like, there were
Yeah.
things that you're happy that happened, you know?
Yeah, there were. And I got to make some lovely acquaintances, I call at the time, because, you know, we don't really stay in touch. There's a guy that I could talk about later on that, down to my drinking and my fault, we completely fell out on a drunken text message that I sent, which a lot of us have been guilty for. The keyboard warrior stuff, you know. Luckily, he forgave me, and we're really good friends again. But I made some amazing acquaintances, and I look at eras in my life. You know, that era was special to me, albeit I don't know how I did it half the time. You know, like getting in from the bar 2:30 in the morning and starting work at 6 in the morning. And a lot of people say, oh, is it really done in 60 minutes? Well, when Peter Andre took over, it wasn't. It was all day, and it made it worse because there were less of us. And some days were really challenging. And some days were like 14, 15 hours, you know. And if you've had 3 hours sleep and you've gone to bed literally plastered, then it's a problem, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. So can you kind of tell us a little bit more? I know you've given us like sort of points there of your journey with alcohol. But can you kind of tell us the sort of full story? Because I obviously I know bits of it, but I feel like there's probably parts of how it started, kind of your mental health journey and things that I probably don't know. I think when we kind of talk about, when we go through like the perspective shifts you're going to give and maybe some advice and bits and bobs like that, obviously your context is really important behind it.
So
is there anything that we're kind of missing with your journey with alcohol?
Well, I kind of started like anyone else. You know, you don't start on a liter of vodka, do you? Because it'll kill you. I started, you know, my mum left when I was 14. She left a letter. She didn't say goodbye or whatnot. And then it wasn't long after that, my dad met someone and she didn't really like me. She wanted my dad all to herself. And I felt really isolated and rejected. And a few lads that I went to school with that I avoided before that kept knocking on the door, you coming out, Dave? What? And I one day I thought, do you know what? Got nothing else to do. And we used to go at the shops, and it was in a place called Carshalton. And the circle was where there was a big shopping, not precinct, but like load of shops there with an off license. And they used to get the adults to go in the office with all the change they'd find down the sofas and stuff and buy us beer. And I only had like a couple of Fosters in that. And all of a sudden I become funny and I loosened up and that. And they really sort of took to me, you know, as the comedian in the group. And that gave me confidence because I was really shy, really insecure. And I kind of took that through normal teens, going out clubbing, never drinking the week, you know, get up for work every day, not a problem. But in my late 20s, I'd lived in this flat. And my next door neighbour used to go to a local pub. And he said one day, do you want to come down there and meet the boys? And I went in there and I was a quick drinker, Charlie. And I soon developed the name Glugs because I could glug down a pint in a couple of minutes, no problem. So I would go down and have 5-6 beers in an hour. And I kind of got my nickname there, Dave the Carpet or Glugs. And it's where I used to go after work. And I used to dump the van off around the corner and walk home. And after a couple of years, people start to kind of say to me, are you all right, Dave? You seem to be caning it a little bit lately. And it really affected me because I thought that's the first time ever people said anything about my drinking. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of reined it in a little bit, but obviously wanted more. So I used to go over the Offie over the road and they sold Diamond White back then. And it's like 8.4% or something. So I'd buy 4 cans, go home and have them. But it wasn't long before I realized that weren't enough. So then I started buying 8 cans. And then I started stopping going to the pub and I'd get a case of Diamond White because it's blow your head off stuff, you know. And then I started putting on loads of weight and I'd become a little bit not crazy, but it was making me a bit psychotic. So I kind of reined that in and started drinking wine. You sort of mix and match when you get to a certain stage, you know. And then I moved. So I moved to this place when I was 40. And the pub nearby I didn't like. It's a carvery and it's very clicky. So I started drinking indoors full time. I didn't ever go out. So it's completely solitary drinking. I would go in every single night, have a few beers and a bottle of wine. But then my weight increased even more and I started to look really rough. So I Googled, the infamous Google, what alcohol has the least amount of calories? And up popped vodka, right? And I never drink spirits ever. So I thought, oh, do you know what? I'll get a half bottle of vodka. I drank it in about 20 minutes, Charlie, because I'm a glugger. So Then I started buying a bottle of vodka, and that wouldn't last the night either. And then I was like, Jesus, this is terrible. But I started buying a liter. And before I knew it, I was drinking the liter of vodka a night, and just passing out. Like, and if I were to look at the bottle and there was a little bit in the bottle, I'd think I'd have an easy night. That's how bad it got, you know? And I started losing friends and not answering the phone. My carpet business was going down the pan because I wasn't going on estimates. Because, for example, if I finished at 3 and I had a measure somewhere at 7, I would text them, say, oh, I'm working late. Can I come another day? And then they reply 2 days later, say, oh, we've got someone else then. And that could have cost me a couple of grand, you know.
Yeah.
But so the drink was becoming a priority in my life. And then I just, you know, I wasn't having any relationships because I couldn't hold them down. I was keeping myself presentable. It wasn't like I turned into an old hobo or anything like that. But I start to lose self-respect for myself because of my weight gain. And I'd look in the mirror and go, I hate you. Like, what have you become? And then it just went on like that, Charlie. And after that, I was in a relationship, and I moved in, and she had kids, and we kind of wasn't long before things started crumbling because I'd kind of hidden it. Because you don't start a relationship and go, oh, by the way, I drink a bottle of vodka a night.
Yeah.
And then one day I just had a bit of a breakdown. The doctor had prescribed me double dose my antidepressants because I was on every medication under the sun because I was basically just staying alive, just about. Blood pressure tablets, cholesterol, anti-reflux, antidepressants, you know, all of these things from my drinking. And I ended up down in Eastbourne and I just went on a complete bender. My phone went flat. I had nowhere to stay. It was Easter weekend. It was hot, actually. So I go to the pub all day long and drink umpteen pints of Stella, go in the co-op, and then I thought I romanticised sitting on the beach at night looking at the stars and the moon, thinking, well, I can do the same again tomorrow. But I was so paralytic that I fell over on the beach, hit my head, cut all my head open. And I did that for 4 days, Charlie, and I don't know how I stayed alive, really, because I could have got murdered, mugged, hypothermia, you know, all that. And I ended up going home. And I was just an absolute mess. And I went back to the doctors and they said, look, I think they realized they had messed up with the antibiotics because I was with the antidepressants because I was psychotic, but you would be on that amount of alcohol as well.
Yeah.
But you know what? I thought this is 2018, just before my mum died. And that was a real rock bottom for me because I remember sitting against a wall. I couldn't find my van because I parked it down some side street and thought, I've got to get to my van to get in the back because I was so cold. And this girl got out of a black cab and she looked at me, she went, you loser, like that, which obviously wasn't a nice thing to say. But I thought, God, this time last week, I was in Chelsea measuring up a flat, you know, for carpet. And now look at me, I'm hunched up against a wall, like virtually homeless. But then a catalogue of events happened in that year with I had an expensive watch stolen. The builders fleeced me for 25 grand. My mum became ill and died. And my drinking actually got worse after that.
Wow.
And then Christmas came and I was just a big mess. And I started a new year, 2019, not knowing what the hell I was doing. I was completely lost in my life, not complete denial, but I didn't feel like I knew what to do to change it. And on the 7th of Jan, 2019, I got a text message. I remember where I was. I was in Wimbledon and I saw it and my friend Piers texted me and he said, how do you feel like joining me for 3 months to stop alcohol, to see where you are with your mental health, your life, everything, you know, just see what happens, join me. And I burst out laughing because I thought I couldn't give up 3 days. And I, throughout the day, I kind of started thinking, I wonder what life would be like. I wonder I wonder what my health would be like, how my anxiety would be, like my job. Would I be going to work with a more positive attitude? And I started asking myself all these questions, and it kind of gave me a bit of a flavor then. And because of the way you framed it, it wasn't, mate, you look terrible, you need to stop drinking. It was, join me and we can do it together. So I texted him back, and I said to him, are you in? And to be honest, Charlie, he's never in. He's one of these people that's always doing something. He said, come and see me. And I went around there and saw him, and I just looked at him and I knew it's the time. And I shook his hand, and that was it. And I've never drank since.
Wow.
And I often wonder as well, I wonder what would have happened if he said, no, I'm not in.
Yeah.
It would have probably been completely different. I wouldn't be here talking to you now because I probably drunk that night, because it was the absolute serendipity of it that I was ready for it, you know? And that's where it all began, mate. And it was day one for me that day. And I didn't know how to do it, what to do, what it meant, or anything, you know? And in hindsight, it was dangerous because the amount I was drinking, I should have reduced. You know, because it's quite dangerous to just stop like that, because you can have seizures and whatever. But back then, I didn't really have the information.
Yeah, mate, that's one hell of a journey. You know, I think you're so spot on there. Like you said, your mate texts you, it was the right time, everything aligned. And I think it's almost got to be, you've got to be in the right headspace. It's got to be the right message said in the right way from the right person. Like almost the stars have got to align, haven't they, sometimes?
Yeah, and there's a thing called spontaneous sobriety, and it might look to people that that's what it was, that I just stopped on that day and that was it. But I knew for a long time that I had to do something because I couldn't carry on like that, you know. And the doctor said to me, you know, you're a ticking time bomb. Even that didn't really mean anything to me, but in my heart, I knew that, you know, if I carried on the way I was, things were going to go completely bandy really quickly, you know. And since I've been recording my podcast, I've heard of lots and lots of stories where people have died a lot younger than me from alcohol use disorder, you know. And not just that, but the knock-on effects of overdrinking, like mental health, you know, and menopause symptoms and cancer, and it's just rife.
What do you, can I ask you a bit of a personal question? What do you feel you were trying to get from the alcohol during that period of time? Was it always the same sort of thing, or was it different periods of your life the alcohol was giving you something else?
I think I used to use it as like medication, and really at the time I didn't really know why, because it's accumulative, right? So I think when I got into my 20s and that, I just basically learned to survive on my own from 14 years old. I didn't have my mum there, and you know, for the needs that some would need, and my dad was struggling on his own, and then he met someone else. So I became very independent at a very young age, you know. But when I got into my late 20s, I started going into that pub. I almost created a fake existence, because it was like I was an actor, because I would create a different personality for a different person. So, example, if there was a solicitor or a doctor in there having a drink, I would change my persona around him. Or if there was a builder, I would change. So I never really knew my true identity. So I went through my life almost playing a role without examining what was really wrong with me. And it wasn't really until I stopped drinking that I got therapy, and I identified that it was a lack of self-worth, lack of self-belief. I had no self-esteem, and obviously the trauma of mum leaving without even saying goodbye. You know, she just left and up, and I didn't know where she was for a whole year, and that in itself is quite traumatic. And it was the self-development that I did after stopping drinking that allowed me the headspace to identify why I was drinking, was to numb it all out. Like I numbed everything out, but also the consequences of my drinking, what that caused, I was numbing out, because I wasn't making good decisions. You know, I was irresponsible, and I wasn't turning up for work, or I wasn't doing the estimates. So I was financially struggling as well. And I remember one night I just slept in my van like night after night because I was just like so lost, Charlie. And it took me to stop for me to really work out why. And that's why I always say to people when they come to me for help is let's try at some point to identify your why, because there's always something. It's not, oh, I love a glass of wine or I love a few beers. There's always a reason why.
Thank you for sharing that, mate. Really appreciate that. My journey with alcohol is obviously very different, and it's all relative though, right? It's everyone's struggles are different, and
yeah.
It's all very individual. But what you just said there really, really resonated with me. I think I used alcohol as a way to, like you say, gain confidence. I was always trying to be the class clown. Do you know what I mean? It gave me self-worth. It gave me a sort of position in the tribe, so to speak. Because I'm the youngest of, and I don't want this to sound very woe is me, because I've had a very cushy life. Like, I've had a brilliant childhood, brilliant upbringing. And really, there's nothing that I can complain about. But being the youngest of four brothers, quite intense bullying, to be honest with you. Like, put it out there. Quite intense bullying at times. When you're 12, 15, 16, you don't think, do you? Like, my brother's never had any harm or cruel intention behind it. It was just Mickey taking and a bit of banter. But obviously, if you're a 8, 9 year old and your brother's a 18, 19, 20, it's quite harsh. You know what I mean? And for me, that really affected my self-confidence, my self-worth, and kind of where I saw myself in the world. Like, I've always felt like I didn't really fit into stuff. Like, in school, wasn't really sporty. Bullied off the rugby team, never picked first for sports. So I've never been a sporty person, not particularly popular or anything like that at school. And then even like in the health and fitness world, but I don't believe in a lot of the stuff that's promoted. So I've always felt like a little bit of a nomad between groups and kind of not like I fit in. But for me, alcohol was that thing. I remember like being 40, I don't know, how old was I? 13, 14? And one of my older brothers, who's 4 years older than me, he was a big rugby lad, always worked in rugby his whole life. He's only just left, and he's 35 now. And he went away on a rugby tour, as they do, and he came back, it must have been Devon or Cornwall or something, and he came back with a glass bottle of Scrumpy with the little circle handle on the top.
Yeah.
And I was like 13, 14, and he just like gave it to me. And it's when I'm saying it now, it sounds really weird. So my parents are downstairs, they've had their dinner and it's like 7, 8 o'clock. And I go upstairs, probably 13, 14. I go to the back of my cupboard, get this bottle of Scrumpy out and I just start drinking it. And I did, it only lasted me about 3 or 4 nights, but I was just getting pissed in my room by myself.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing when you think about it now. My parents had absolutely no idea. But for me, it was that feeling, like you say, of like I felt floaty and I felt funny and giddy and I felt like I could do anything. And it sort of gave me this like sense of freedom that I'd never had before.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuck with me. And the other thing for me was always my brothers were obviously older and drinking was a big part of their 16 to 20s. Do you know what I mean? That period of life. And I've got one brother in particular, the second one up, he always looked about 10 years older. So he'd be 14 and he had the lamb chop sideburns.
Yeah.
And he was very dark skinned. So he had dark hair and he looked older and he could be going down the pub drinking Guinness at 14, 15, like ridiculous. Yeah. And I'd always aspire to be like my brothers because I never felt like I really fit in and they're all very different. Do you know what I mean? They probably felt something quite similar. But I'd always aspire to be like them. So my thing was I'd go out, we'd go out for a night, 15, 16, my parents would go out for a meal. I'd sneak in the kitchen. I'd get the bottle of vodka. I'd put it into a plastic bowl. I'd top it up with water. Then I'd add a bit of gin to it. And I'd just go out on the streets with this bottle, plastic little Evian bottle of God knows what you call it. Just like this random mix of 4 or 5 different types of alcohol. Cause I wouldn't want to take much. So I take a little bit from everything. And then I don't know if I was the first one to start drinking my friend group, but I was definitely one of the first because I'd go out, get blood. And as you say, it would give you the confidence and I'd be the class clown. I'd be the funny guy. And honestly, it's embarrassing now looking back, the stupid, stupid decisions I would make, the stuff I would do.
We've all got stories, haven't we? Like it's horrendous. But the thing is, Charlie, a lot of people, they go through those stages and they get into their 20s and then they start growing up and then they start reducing. Then it doesn't become a problem. But for others, it carries on and just escalates. And You know, I always remember Jimmy Nail. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's an actor who was in Alfiedersen and Pet and that, and he's a big old Geordie bloke. And he was in his 40s in a club, nightclub, and he was falling out the club, and a bouncer said to him, "Hey, Jimmy," I can't even do the accent, I won't even try, but he basically said to him, "Aren't you a bit old for this now?" And it really hit a note for him to sort of ask himself, "What am I doing? You know, I've got kids, I've got a family, a job, like what am I doing?" And but it's alcohol is such an addictive drug, isn't it? It's everywhere you look, and it's justified wherever you go. You know, you give up smoking, or you give up caffeine, or you're losing a bit of weight, and everyone's got their arm around you. But you say you're stopping drinking, and they're all like, "What are you doing? Well, don't be boring," especially around this time of year. You know, like it's just madness. You know, you have to justify stopping drinking because of the way society is, and it's crazy.
Really, really is. And this is my first sober Christmas. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to waking up with energy, not having a cracking hangover, not wrapping presents in tin foil because I haven't wrapped them the night before because I've gone out on the piss. Like, I'm looking forward to it. But that leads me really, really nicely onto a point I was going to ask you. So I actually had a client the other day message me and say, I know you've stopped drinking, da da da. I've got the school staff Christmas party. And I really want to drive and I don't want to drink. And they were really, really worried about like that social pressure and that social influence. So I kind of said that very anecdotally, not really particularly like evidence-based, but I said, like, look, I'm not an expert in this, but this is what I've done in those situations. This what's worked really well for me. But what would you suggest? Like, let's say that someone is going into Christmas and they do want to reduce their alcohol a little bit, or maybe not drink at all. But they've got like either the friends or the family who have got that kind of culture and they've got that kind of relationship with alcohol. What can someone do to kind of manage this? Because it's a really intense period, isn't it?
It really is, and it's so difficult because people expect you to drink, and if you say you're not, they think you've gone mad. You know, at Christmas, it's like, "What, are you mad? It's Christmas, of course you're having a drink." But there's a number of reasons why you don't need to drink. You know, mental health, anxiety. You know, it could be you could say you're having a health kick before Christmas, or tell them before as well. Like, rather than go there and just walk in and go, "Oh, by the way, I'm driving," you're going to get a load of abuse. It's like, drop it in beforehand and just say, "Do you know, I've got to drive because I've got an early start next day," or, you know, make up something that works for you. Like, think outside the box because we're all different, as you said earlier. So one thing might not work for another person. But I also like say, don't give it too much energy because otherwise you're like a rabbit in the headlights and people will pick up on that. And just say, "Do you know what? I'm not drinking tonight, but I'm here and I'm going to have a good time." And you can always do the French exit as well and nip out the back because it does get boring a little bit. I mean, people say we're boring by not drinking, but you being in a room full of drunk people, trust me, that's boring.
That's what I've noticed. Like, we went out for did you go out for a meal? I think we just went out and started drinking. Obviously, I was on the non-alcoholic beers, but a few weeks ago we went out and started drinking. And I think I went about 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I left about 7:30. But a few people came out about 4 or 5. So they'd obviously not had as much of the day. But if you've gone out at 2 o'clock and it's 7:30, people are spilling their drinks, people are starting to slur. And if you're not drinking, you're sort of sitting there like, starting to get a bit tired now. Like, this is conversation goes down a little bit. People were just
And you
giggling.
know, like, I don't want to come across like a Scrooge as well because people are having a great time. But you know, my girlfriend had a Christmas party the other day, and it was lovely. When she left at 10:30, it was the best night. But when she went into work a couple of days later and heard what had happened from 10:30 till the end, it was a completely different story. You know, and it goes to show how things decline quickly when you've had too much to drink. Arguments, swearing. You know, I've been in the same situation myself where someone's bumped. And I'm not aggressive either. I hate all that sort of stuff, but someone's nudged into me, and all of a sudden I've flipped because I've had too much to drink. You know, your nervous system's all over the shop, And you wake up in the morning, you don't even remember half of it, you know, and it's just, I don't want to do it anymore. You know, I've lived a life for 5 years without it now, and it's just so good. Everything is better, and you never get anyone that stopped drinking say they regret it either.
No, I didn't think, like, I thought it would be good, and I was looking forward to not drinking and stuff. I didn't think it would be how it is. Like, there's just no way I'm going back. But yeah, I definitely didn't realize how powerful it would be.
It's often the opposite as well of what you think. You know, like, I'll give, for example, me, when I thought I'm going to stop drinking, my first thing was, it's my life is over. My life is going to be really boring. I'm going to lose all my friends. You know, all these things that come into my head. And it was the opposite. I lost drinking buddies, but if they were real friends, they would have stuck with me anyway. They would have gone, good for you, mate. Well done. I'm proud of you. Actually, I'm going to think about changing things for me as well. But they didn't. They carried on. And I met someone recently, and he looked absolutely terrible. Absolutely really unhealthy and unwell, you know. I've made so many amazing friends, including yourself, in this community. And I've been introduced to different people in different areas. And, you know, everything is richer in my life. And I'm not just talking money. I'm talking about quality of life every day when I wake up. And I always talk about the nervous system, because it's regulated now. You know, before I was either really up or really down. I had mood swings. I was depressed. I had no motivation. I was lost, totally lost. And now I look forward to Mondays. Like, when I wake up Monday, I'm actually excited, thinking, I wonder what this week is going to bring, rather than how am I going to get through even till lunchtime, let alone the rest of the week, you know. So it's quite often the opposite. And there'll be people listening to this feeling, yeah, I don't know how I'm going to do it and that. But this is why I do these podcasts, because I want to encourage people to at least question it, maybe, their relationship with alcohol, going, you know, why am I drinking? What does it look like to me? How is it serving me? How can my life look better? Even if I reduce for now, you know, like, I have my own theory on moderation that we can cover if you like, but as in reducing gradually, so it's not such a problem. You know, there's always ways of trying to make it better.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said earlier, like, we all, like, have a different approach and different relationship with alcohol, obviously. So the way that we're going to reduce it or cut it out or whatever we do is going to be different as well. But I think I know what your sort of theory on moderation is, but we'll go into that. For me, though, I had to close the door. I couldn't be 98% in, because that 2%, all it took was a certain friend or a certain event, me feeling a bit self-conscious, you know, me feeling a bit insecure, me feeling a little bit socially awkward. One mate goes, go on, just one too many times. If that 2%, if that door's ajar, I'm having that drink, and I am then 10 pints in, and I'm anxious and I'm stressed and I'm tired for the rest of the month. Like, it genuinely has that impact. So for me, and this is what quite a few of my friends I don't think have really clocked onto, is that that's now it. Like, I'm done. I've drunk loads. I've got the stories. I've got the silly tales. I've got the good times and the lads' holidays and the fun stuff, but I've had enough of that now. Like, for me, it's black and white. But what's your kind of take on moderation?
100% with you there, mate. Like, I looked at it like I was in a relationship with alcohol. I always humanize it, that it's like having an affair with a real slinky mistress, you know, and she's terribly toxic, narcissistic, and really bad for me, but the temptation's there. So you go 2 or 3 days and you think, oh, I haven't seen her or text her or anything, and oh, maybe I can just meet her once, kind of thing. You can't live like that, because alcohol is very, very addictive, right? And once it's got its claws around you, you know, I compare it to like poison ivy, where it wraps itself around your toe. And then if you allow it to, which we do, if we love the glass of wine a bit too much or the beers, it grows up. And then before you know it, it's got you around the throat. right? So you have to cut that ivy. You've got to kill it, like you have. You've cut it dead, right? And it's like the relationship. I had to end it. I had to block it. But every now and again, she might appear in the high street, like pop up somewhere, because it does, doesn't it? Alcohol, you can't just get rid of it because it's everywhere. So I had to cut it dead. And I often say to people, if you want to see if you've got a problem with alcohol, give it up for a month and then see how you feel. Because if you really, really struggle, then you've got a problem. You're not a take it or leave it drinker.
Yeah.
Or can you have one drink and then carry on with soft drinks or a cup of tea for the rest of the night? Because I know for a lot of people, you have one drink and then you want another one, then you want another one. Before you know it, you've drunk a bottle of wine and you've had eight pints of bloody lager. So there are signs. And if you see the sign that actually I can't do that, or I can't moderate, or I can go a week without a drink because I'm working, yet at the weekends I binge drink. You know, these are all signs that there's a problem there. And I always suggest to people, look, give yourself the opportunity and take a month off. But in that month, don't be a victim and be going, oh, I wish I could be like everyone else. Really embrace it and think, this is like an experiment. Like, the experiment with yourself and do loads of journaling and write down how you feel. Like, some days are easier than others. Like, identify your drinking times. I call them like the opening hours. So say, for instance, you were getting from work and it would be 7 o'clock. Around about six, you're going to start, oh, I can have a drink soon. And you get all excited, you get a dopamine hit. So you have to plan ahead and think, right, I need to do something different. Otherwise, the cravings are going to come in, the triggers are going to come in, and it's going to drive you up the wall because you'll be white knuckling it. And then you end up having a tantrum and either drinking or going to bed sulking. So you have to make a plan. And this is why it's good to be really positive about it. Because after all, right, at the end of the month, you ain't going to be worse off, are you? 100% you're going to feel better off. That's why I say be excited about it. So if you joined the gym, you could go to the gym, or you could, if you don't feel like that, you know, it's not all about climbing mountains, is it? It's about embracing that time off. So you could read some quicklets, you could watch some box sets on Netflix, you could take the dog out if you've got one, you could watch a film with the kids if you've got kids. You know, there's a million things that you can do to fill the void of that time, because most people I know get to a point in the evening that it doesn't matter anymore. So you're to seven, probably by 8:30, 9, you go, do you know, I'm all right, actually. And it's important to identify those times to get through that day. And before you know it, you've done 3-4 days. And then you think, do you know what? I've done really well. But then comes in the reward imp of the mind where it's like, we've done really well. Maybe you could have one. So yeah, we've all been there and all, where we've had a bit of time off. We've been there with food as well, where you might have eaten really sensibly in the week, and on a Friday night or Saturday, you're out and you see a lovely bakery and you think, do you know what? I'd love a bloody cinnamon swirl with a coffee or something, you know. But with food, it's different from booze, because you can't just have the one glass because you'd be back on it again. So you have to stick to the plan, you know. And I honestly say, if you go into it and embrace it, like, say, for instance, dry Jan, don't be going into it thinking, oh, I can get absolutely plastered in February. There's no point doing it. Think, right, I'm going to assess how I'm going to be at the end of January. I'm going to monitor how I look, how I feel, how my mental health is, how my anxiety is, how my motivation is, how my clarity at work is, you know, if you're sharper, how your relationships are indoors with your work colleagues and whatever, and take all this data at the end of the month and think, right, how will things be if I start again? Because I can guarantee within a couple of weeks you'll be back to the old cycle. So say, give yourself another week or another 2 weeks and see how you feel after 6 weeks, and then keep going. You know, that's an option. But the other way around is what you did, which was how I did it. And it was, that's it. Because I couldn't sort of muck about with it. I had to end it there and there. So it's like, I always think of it like a rope, like a tug of war rope. And quite often we go, oh, I'm going to end it. And we go and cut through, but there's a few strands there hanging and it pulls you back in. But with me, I had to make sure it was severed and lay dangling down next to me that it's like, right, that's done now. And I know where I am. It's like a non-negotiable now. That's it. I'm not drinking. And I looked at it like I was allergic to it, because if I drink, it will kill me. And that was it. Like a nut allergy, you know, and that's how I look at my sobriety.
I love that. That's a really, really good way to look at it. Yeah. You sort of allergic. It's just something you just can't have, sort of thing, you know?
Yeah. It's out of the question now. Yeah.
Yeah. Something I heard, I can't remember where I heard this from. If I remember, I'll put it in the show notes or something. But someone said to me recently, if you're not a smoker and someone comes up to you and says, do you want a fag? You're not going to go, do I want a cigarette? Have a think about it. What brand are they? Is it the one I like? You know, you got Rollies, you know, whatever. You'd say, no, I don't smoke.
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of what I said to that client I was chatting to the other day. For me, it's not become my whole identity. You know, it's not all I think about and talk about, but it is now part of my identity. And if someone says to me, do you want a drink? My answer is now just like, either no, or have you got a non-alcoholic beer? But that's kind of it. And like when we go out for dinner and stuff, we've been my birthday and Christmas, obviously, we've been out quite a lot recently. And when the waitress or waiter comes over and says, do you want a drink? I'd be like, what non-alcoholic beers have you got, please? Like that is now just my first answer, you know? And I think if someone come up to me and said, do you want a cigarette? I'm not going to say yes, because it probably make me throw up. Like I'm not a smoker. So now I'm also not a drinker.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
but, that, you know, you can frame it as well. I don't drink. It's just blunt and straight to the point, right? Because before I was like, oh, I'm trying not to drink. And people go, you know, if you said I'm trying not to smoke, they go, have a fag. I'm trying to not drink. I'm trying to stop drinking, or I'm having a break. Ah, just have a drink, you know. So you have to be really firm with your answer. And if you are doing this month thing, you have to be firm and say, you know, I'm taking a month off and I'm loving it. You know, like be really positive. Otherwise you go, I'm taking a month off, but I could really do with a glass of wine. Well, you've lost the battle, right? So you need to make your boundaries really clear from the beginning and commit to it. And so, like you said, like, to be honest, mate, I don't really have the non-alcoholic drinks anymore. They don't bother me, but I don't drink. And I look at them cold stone in the face, like, and they don't know what to say to me. I think I've got a look. Victoria, my girlfriend, thinks I've got a train look, because I gave someone a look on a train and they literally froze to stone on the train. So I give them that look and they won't even question me.
Yeah. I mean, you're not a small guy either. You're pretty tall. So
yeah. But you know, the thing is, like, if you're confident in what you're doing, then, you know, there's no reason to worry. I'm totally confident that I'm a non-drinker now, and I'm proud of it. I was in a pub full of a load of big, massive rugby blokes and whatever, and I went up to the bar and said, can I have a lime and soda, please? I thought, I don't care if you even dig me out on it.
Yeah,
I'm proud of it. I really am, because it's changed my whole life completely. And I'm here now, and I feel healthy and well, and I'm well. My next birthday, Charlie, I can't believe it. I'm a proper geriatric, and I apologise to people who are older than that, but I'll be 60 on my next birthday. But this is what I'm trying to tell people. You're never, ever too old to change your life. I was 54 when I stopped drinking, right? And I thought that was it. 4 decades of drinking, and I mean, like, towards the end, it was ludicrous by drinking, you know, like chronic drinking. And I've completely turned it around at 54. So I want that to reach people who think they can't change, because they can. But you need the right support, the right community, which is, you know, on social, there's some incredible communities out there, and the right mindset, and you can do anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any... just to sort of wrap us up, is there anything, we've been talking a lot about like Christmas and January, and I think you're absolutely right, like dry Jan's is a big thing now, isn't it? I think lots of people listening to this will probably be like sober curious, maybe thinking about kind of, you know, dipping a toe in January. Are there any like really common mistakes? And I guess it's the opposite of what we've been talking about, but are there any really common mistakes that people tend to make when they do start to reduce or cut out alcohol? Like, what are some of the really common pitfalls that you see?
I think listening to the voice on your shoulders, one, you know, like we've got the two voices, and we've got the angel on our shoulder that's saying, "Come on, Charlie, you're doing so well. I'm really proud of you. Get another week under the belt and you're doing brilliantly." And the other one is like, "Mate, what are you doing? Like, you're not one of the lads anymore." And we kind of tend to listen to that voice, right? But you've got to block it out. And I used to humor mine. I used to go, "Oh, you're back again, are you? But you know what? I ain't listening." You know, like, I identify that's going to happen because it will do, whoever we are. You know, you can be the strongest person in the world, that voice will always creep in. Also, don't forget your plan, because a lot of people start off with a plan and it all goes belly up after a few days. And that's when you feel isolated. So you're not connecting with a, say, a community, or you're not listening to the podcast or reading the Quitlets or going to the gym, or you're letting things slip a little bit. That's when things can start to get really tricky. So it's sticking to the plan. And always, again, like, remind yourself that things will get better every single day you don't drink, because it is a poison. You know, not even one glass is good for you. That old myth is well and truly buried. No element of alcohol is good for you at all. And that's the other thing, Charlie, I ever mentioned as well. You don't have to be drinking a bottle of vodka a night for alcohol to be a problem. It could be a couple of glasses of wine and it affects your sleep or your anxiety, or you might go into work in the morning and feel a little bit rough and you haven't got clarity in that. So ask yourself, does alcohol affect me on a daily basis? Even if you're not drinking, you could feel rough from the weekend, or you know, you could have 2 or 3 days of feeling under the weather from it, and then you start drinking again. So you're back on the spiral. So create the plan, stick to it, feel positive, do the journaling, listening to the podcast, read the books, and feel positive. And all those things are all put together like a recipe in a big cooking pot. They all start to blend together. And you, but then one day you look in the mirror and you go, "Do you know what? I look actually really good today, and I feel positive, and my anxiety isn't as bad, and I'm actually feeling excited for the week ahead and stuff." And bingo, there you are. It's beginning to kick in. And remind yourself that it doesn't all happen at once. You know, you don't give up drinking and you lose a stone and you're running 10K. It doesn't happen. So you have to be patient. But every day that you don't drink is a step forward. And as you're proof of that, after a few months, and me as well, that, and thousands of others that I've spoken to, that life just gets so much better and things are changing as well. This whole stigma around drinking and whatever is changing. There are more and more people of all ages not drinking now, and I think it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. One thing that we didn't sort of we didn't mention, I didn't mention earlier, was when we were talking about like where we came from with alcohol and stuff like that. We also spoke about like identity and like self-worth and confidence and stuff like that. And I just want to kind of mention it here, because if you are thinking about maybe reducing alcohol in January, I think this is a really important point. For me, alcohol was always like a quick fix and like a blanket. Like, it gave me a bit of confidence in the social occasions, and it gave me a bit of this and a bit of that. But actually, you're always sort of putting a plaster over it. You're always constantly painting over the cracks, but the cracks are always there. So I think if you're listening to this after Christmas or in January, and you're thinking like, "I've just got through Christmas," like you drunk your way through Christmas, maybe all the social occasions, or you know, or sometimes family are like, you know, the person that always asks you, "Oh, you know, when you're getting married, when you're doing this, when you're doing that." If you've drunk your way through all of that family time, if you continue like that, you're going to keep painting over the cracks of how you feel. Whereas for me, it was very much, I don't want to rely on a drug to make me feel confident. I want to get rid of it, and I want to go to the, like, the root of the problem, and I want to tackle the root of the problem. And it's really weird. Again, I don't want to like not glorify, that's not the right word, but I don't want to like paint a perfect rosy picture of giving up drinking and stuff. But what happened for me was when I realized that I could say no when I went out, when people went out drinking, and I was there and I was sober, it actually gave me this weird hit of confidence.
Yeah.
And it built up my self-belief in myself because I no longer needed to get bladdered to be with my friends, to enjoy myself. And I think we drink to, what I'm trying to say is we drink to give ourselves self-confidence, but actually when we cut out drinking, it gives us this really like unique type of self-confidence.
Yeah. And that's so what I said earlier. It's quite often the opposite of what we think, you know, like, and it's important to say as well that some people drink because of past trauma as well. So I always say do the practical bit at the beginning, which is actually stop drinking and then reach out to a qualified therapist or counselor that can help you with dealing with that grief, some childhood trauma. You know, it's important to work out the reasons why, because as you say, it's a temporary fix, temporary solution to the problem. We numb out. A lot of us that drink are overthinkers, you know, our brains are 100 miles an hour. As you've probably heard recently, there's a lot of addicts or people that are gamblers or, you know, into drugs or alcohol that have ADHD, because there's so many symptoms of that that are the reason why we drink. You know, I'm a chronic overthinker, but what I've found is by stopping drinking has calmed my nervous system down that much that I don't overthink so much. So it's almost solved itself. Mm. And if I do start overthinking, I'm more rational about it rather than I'm either high or low. I'm kind of ticking along the middle and I rationalize it and I work out how to solve that problem naturally, which is real life, right? Yeah. So it's about kind of taking life by the scruff of the neck and going, do you know what? I can handle you now, because I've got the right support and I'm not changing my mind every single day or whenever you're drinking to manage it. I'm not pouring alcohol down my throat to be able to cope with life, because it how long does it last, Charlie? Not long, does it? You know, like what, hour and a half probably?
Yeah.
And then you're back to overthinking, but 10 times worse.
Yeah. Yeah. That was it for me. Like for me, it was the Monday. If I drank heavy on a Saturday, and when I say drunk heavy, I'd go out, I'd lose myself because I felt so much part of the tribe and the rest of the tribe were all on their fifth, sixth, seventh pint. I would just follow along basically. And I'm talking like I've been, you know, ill out of the window at 70 miles per hour in my partner's car. That was one from last year. And you reel out the window at 70 mile per hour, ain't staying outside. It comes back in.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's terrible.
It was horrendous. She didn't talk to me for a week, which is fair enough. Like I'm talking like that level. When I got like that on a Saturday, Monday, which is my check-in day with clients, I would be groggy, tired. I'd be anxious. I'd be having heart palpitations. I'd be overthinking. Yeah. It would take me till Thursday to feel back to myself, to get myself in the gym, to do things that for me that are good, that make me feel good. And then on Saturday, I'd start again. And even if I was drinking just once a week, it's 6 days it takes from you. And you get one good day out of seven.
Yeah. That's not living, is it? I mean, this, you know, I always say if it was a meal that you knew would give you food poisoning, say paella, seafood or something, and you was ill for 2 or 3 days, you wouldn't go near it after that. But because alcohol's a addictive drug, we kind of forget it, how bad we feel, and then immediately going back to it, you know? And it's so bad. It's so bad that we live this life of these short-term fixes and highs of the drinking to suffer for so long to then go back. And that's the hamster wheel of drinking, isn't it? When you're just going round and round and round, same routine week in, week out, before you know it, the year's gone. And, you know, you're nowhere different from where you were a year ago. And you can be different with the right mindset and support.
Absolutely. Is there anything that you'd really like to leave people with today? Like any particular message or quote or just a thought as they kind of take everything that they've listened to and maybe think about putting into practice?
I think, Charlie, like if there's any part of this interview that people have thought, do you know what? Yeah, that's me, or they identify to any of this conversation, take some time out, 20 minutes, half an hour, a cup of tea, and just really think about how your life is with drink involved in it. You know, like, how does it look like to you? And try and visualize life without it, without the normal cliches of, oh, it'd be boring or whatever. Think outside the box and think of all the positives of, like you and me have said, how our lives have improved. And again, it's often the opposite. And allow yourself the opportunity to explore maybe taking a break from alcohol, even if it's a week or a month. Just think, do you know what? I'm going to do it and I'm going to see how I feel at the end of it. And think about the quality of your life moving forward. You know, for me, my quality of life is a million times better than, well, I'd be surprised if I would still be here, to be fair. And just visualize your life without booze on a positive angle of your health, your mental health, your anxiety, your relationship, all of that, which I mentioned before, and almost taste it and think, right, okay, next stage is like, how do I do that? And hopefully we've covered it in this interview, but again, you start on day one positively and you create a plan, and it'd be a bespoke plan. You know, whatever time you drink, make sure you eat properly, plenty of protein, and just try and live that healthy lifestyle for a month and give yourself that opportunity to see the change by the end of it, and then decide what to do after that. And I think that alone is a plan, because when we just go, oh, I must stop drinking, we don't know what we're doing. You know, we're white knuckling as well. You might go a couple of days and then you go back to it because you haven't got a plan. So it's really, really important to create that structure and stick to it.
That's awesome. No, thank you, mate. Where can people find more about you? I know at the moment I've seen you've got the course, you've got these awesome things going on. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how people can get in contact with you and maybe work with you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm on Sober Dave on Instagram, or soberdave.co.uk, or all my links for that all over my Instagram. And I've got my podcast, One for the Road. I've got a book out, One for the Road, which is always ironic because that's what we used to say, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. One for the Road. But I've had some amazing guests on there. You'll be on there soon, mate. And, you know, all my resources of help and support on there. I'm doing a live every day in January. I don't know when this is out. But, you know, I'm always doing things throughout the year to try and help people beat this, because I'm really passionate about that. And it's not about being judgy or anything. It's about being there. And quite often it's at the right time, because when people reach out to me, they're ready, or they want to explore something, you know. And I like to think that my Instagram page is a page full of resources and information and education, so they can at least look through that and then decide what to do after that.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Thank you, mate. I appreciate that.
The work you do is just fantastic.
Thank you, Charlie. I do a thing every single January for Dry January, and I'll get guests on my lives, and we talk about their journey. I get people that can give their own perspective of how they did giving up alcohol. They are really, really good. Now, I know thousands of people have got sober off the back of these Dry January lives as well. So it gives the right support at the right time. And it's the best way to start 2024 is to stop drinking, and it could be your year of change.
Yeah, amazing. Definitely go check that out. I'll be watching.
All right, Charlie. Well, I'm going to invite you on after this interview. So
yeah. I'll be there.
All right, mate. I really appreciate you as well recording this with me.
No, thank you very much, mate. And thank you for your time so close to Christmas as well, mate. Really, really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you, mate.